2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 261, Does It Matter How We Remember the Abandonment of Plural Marriage? Papers presented by Kathleen Flake and D. Michael Quinn.
Don't you think you have to sit between us?
Yeah, I think so. That would be a good idea. Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. We got one mic. There's nothing we can do.
Michael, ask him.
Michael doesn't remember me either.
I forgot to bring out my printout of the questions.
Oh, well, then I didn't bring any, and I didn't, so, we'll wing it. Do it, whatever.
We'll have a real conversation.
I don't have 10 minutes to say. I'm just talking.
Oh, were we supposed to prepare a 10-minute?
No, we're okay.
Because I don't have anything.
We're happy.
I was going to follow your lead, oh, fearless one.
Follow my lead.
Nice.
Well, it's only an hour and a half.
No, it's only an hour, isn't it?
What time is it? 3:30. We go to 4:30. Okay, only an hour. That's easy.
Welcome!
Do I have the right... Where's my page here? Okay. You have to touch it when the light goes off. You know that. Welcome to a conversation between Kathleen Flake and Michael Quinn. Until Kathleen Flake's book came on the scene, she and Michael Quinn held the authority of the first part of the 20th century about Mormonism and polygamy. He was the authority. Kathleen Flake is rivaling that. And you are watching the contest here. For those of you who weren't in Kathleen's session the previous hour, I'll give a plug for her book, which is on sale at Benchmark Books. The Politics of American Religious Identity, The Seating of Senator Reed Smoot, Mormon Apostle. This is a great book. If you don't buy another book this year, buy this book and read it.
With your permission.
With my permission?
What's your commission? What's your commission?
Oh. What am I paying? I will dedicate all of my commission to Sunstone. So. Kathleen Flake is an assistant professor of religious studies at Vanderbilt University. She graduated with her PhD from Chicago University, where she interviewed and was given the best job offered in the country that year for her position. Michael Quinn is very known to this symposium. He speaks almost every year, usually more than one session. And he speaks even in sessions, he stands up and gives his mind, too. One of Mike's most famous books, this is one volume of the two-volume series, Mormon Hierarchy. Mike documents case after case of instances of the use of Mormon power. He is, I think, the best person who has gathered little facts that you can't forget and that force you to restructure your understanding of how things work in Mormonism. And they're always more human and more gritty than they were before. But you cannot return to the way you viewed things before after reading Mike's books. Mike's great magnum opus that he promised us that for years he would write was going to be a long, exhaustive, comprehensive history of Mormon polygamy, social, economic, relationships. But he got older, and you know how it gets. You just don't want to write another book. And he put a lot of that data, which didn't put in those books, in these books. So if you haven't bought these and digested the appendixes, they're just wonderful bathtub reading. The question, let me just read our abstract here so we can know where we're going to respond. 20 years ago, Michael Quinn demonstrated that plural marriage had been actively practiced within the church after the 1890 manifesto. That was that famous dialogue article, which was just so groundbreaking, you know, that we practiced polygamy after we said we weren't. Kathleen Flake's recent book tries to explain why that was that we practiced plural marriage after the manifesto, and what finally motivated the church to abandon the practice between 1905 and 1910 in the context of the seating of Apostle Reed Smoot in the U.S. Senate. This session explores ways of understanding these pivotal, turbulent, and dramatic changes and why it matters. So first we'll just ask Kathleen to give us a little nutshell on why we changed our practice of plural marriage during those years. You can do that in a paragraph or two.
Well, the poor people who were here last hour will just have to hear it. I argue we changed it because we finally got something we needed more than the retention of the doctrine. That I don't really accept the argument of social accommodation, but rather present it as a matter of negotiation.
So what's social accommodation?
Capitulation.
The government was too big and powerful and we just gave in.
We just gave in. So what I argue instead is that in 1901, the church's missions were sufficiently prevented from doing their work that the church's raison d'etre was being challenged, that it could not serve its purpose for being unless it managed to negotiate a solution to the Mormon problem. So in the past, the fight had only been, the only thing the church had to gain was survival. And that required them to see that abandoning polygamy wouldn't cause them to die, in other words. But they thought if they abandoned polygamy, they would die, so they never gave it up. I mean, we've all done this personally, right? So in 1901, it was possible to put a senator, to elect Apostle Smoot to the Senate. His staying there enabled the church, I argue, to follow the American flag abroad and to establish the church's missions. Whereas prior to this, there was formal government action internationally as well as domestically in the United States that forbade proselytizing, physically attacked missionaries, interdicted immigration from abroad. Through the auspices of Senator Smoot, all that changed, particularly in 1923, when as the ranking Republican senator on the Senate Finance Committee and representative on the War Reparations Committee, where Europe was going to get the money to rebuild itself after World War I, he then traveled with John A. Widtsoe as his junior companion to meet with the governments of Northern Europe and got the missionaries back in. The question becomes, this is a very neat argument, was it intentional? We talked about this last hour, but the point is, the internationalization of the church, the ability to bear its witness around the world, was the price, that was the benefit that the church obtained by sacrificing polygamy.
So we gave up something we valued, polygamy, for something we valued more, preaching the gospel.
Well, that sounds lame to say, just preaching the gospel.
Okay.
If you put it in the context of Ensign to the Nation, I would be more comfortable. The whole
Ensign to the Nation, it
yes.
is.
Yes.
Okay, Mike, what would you add or detract or supplement from this?
Well, I think an overlay on this is, and it's an overlay on the manifesto in 1890. Why that happened, how people reacted to it, both in the hierarchy. It's an overlay for why polygamy continued after 1890, and it's an overlay about this accommodation that Kathleen Flake describes, is Mormon millennialism. And the perception on the part of most Mormons in the 1880s that the world was coming to an end within 10 years. And the perception, even after the manifesto, that, well, this is a humiliating, temporary surrender because it won't matter in a few years. God is coming, and the kingdom of God will spread throughout the millennial world. And a part of this accommodation was possible only because general authorities like Joseph F. Smith and others began in their own worldview pushing the second coming into the distant future. And if the second coming is in the distant future and not right here and now, then accommodation becomes crucial. We're not talking about temporary surrender of polygamy. We're not talking about temporary peace with the federal government. And I think that is one of the Quorum of the Twelve, for those of you who don't know, were really there was a real division about this issue of surrendering polygamy in the first place and then the issue of whether to continue it secretly afterwards. And it was very divisive. But an overlay for many of those individuals on either side of that was this question of millennialism.
No, I think that's right. I think that Joseph F. Smith, you see him situating the church for the long haul.
So we can agree and close up.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it seems to me that it is very hard for people who, as I understand it, polygamy was central to something that the understanding of Mormonism at that time. How do we give up something that's so central and still maintain, as I think Mormons did then and do now, the myth that we are unchanging and still the same church that Joseph Smith organized, because this was his last revelation that we were no longer going to practice? How did they do that in that decade? And start at believing it as central, and at the end it's almost, you know, in the appendix.
Well, I think this conversation asks the question, not should it have ended, but it does get to this question of what are the consequences of ending it, and focuses on the issue of how does it matter how we remember how it ended, right? That's the question before us today.
Okay, how we remembered it ended.
Yeah, so in how you've phrased your comment to me, it implies a certain understanding of polygamy, that it was central. And there are many Latter-day Saints today who would argue that it was not. That the centrality of polygamy was what could have been, say, a consequence of political brinksmanship, that the church was forced to make First Amendment arguments that drew polygamy further into the core of its doctrine, because it could only obtain First Amendment protection if plural marriage were a central tenet. And so therefore they had to draw it back in. Some people might argue that it was a function of sentimental attachment or an overly concrete imagination on Brigham Young's part, that it was never intended to be what it was. I mean, Latter-day Saints have done a number of things with polygamy. They've understood it a number of ways. And the question becomes, what difference does it make how we remember it? So, for example, when President Hinckley goes on Larry King Live, he presents one way of remembering the end of polygamy.
Which is,
we have nothing to do with them. I think he was talking about modern polygamists. But I just read this comment recently where I saw them, and I thought he said it. We have nothing to do with it. And so some people think we have nothing to do with it. A friend of mine who teaches teenagers in a Salt Lake City ward was talking to them about polygamy, and they could not have cared less. You might as well have talked about Oliver Cromwell and the Round Hats. It was not on their screen, as they're inclined to say. It was not. Those were the old guys. It had nothing to do with them. People, and maybe as they got older, you might say, well, people go to excess in the early days of a religious movement. Therefore, this was an example of excess. So it is the question of what difference does it make how you remember the end. Not how did we compensate for ending it, although those are related. And so we have the interesting dilemma of, I argue, when it is ended, between 1904 and, you know, you have to pick your dates here, 1911, 1913, when the wheels begin to turn to institutionally stop the practice. they have something in mind that appears to contemplate retaining the conviction of its truthfulness is a bad, not necessarily an accurate word here, but certainly the conviction that polygamy was a revelation from God to Joseph Smith. This is a question for a social scientist to do a study on. Do Latter-day Saints still think that? And how do they remember the end of polygamy if they do not think that? So when those individuals who affected the plan by which plural marriage would cease to be practiced, they tried to draw a balance between retaining the belief and stopping the practice.
Mm-hmm.
Some might argue that we still retain the belief in the present practices, but I think that others account for our present practice of multiple ceilings and temples as a sign of our confusion about marital life beyond the veil. That, you know, like other things, we don't know quite what to do with it, so better to err on the side of grace. And I don't say that facetiously. I think I had a young bishop say that to me once when I asked him how he made his decisions. Actually, it had to do with someone who didn't have the priesthood was blessing the sacrament at the time. This was an inner-city ward, and we weren't really in control of everything. But the question was, do we stop him, or what do we do? And I asked this young man about it, and he said he was instructed to err on the side of grace. And I think some people look at our practice of second wife sealings and say, well, this is what we're doing, because we don't know what we're doing. But generally, we do not explain, we have not explained this, and so people are making up their own minds about what it meant to end polygamy.
I think everything she said is great, and I agree with. I just think there's another dimension, too, and that is the issue of nostalgia. Do Mormons who think about polygamy, and you point out, I think quite rightly, that there are a lot of issues that young Mormons don't think of that are a part of Mormonism that their parents stew about and that they couldn't care less about as teenagers. And that may persist beyond the teenage years. But for Mormons who look back nostalgically on this period, what do they look back on nostalgically? Do they look back nostalgically on the abandonment of polygamy and how wonderful that is, or do they look back nostalgically on the pre-abandonment days and the old-time religion? And that's a real dividing point, I think, in Mormon culture for Mormons who think about polygamy. Where do your nostalgic feelings center? Are you centering them on dear old Wilford Woodruff and what a wonderful, brave man he was to issue the manifesto and to end this practice? Or do you look at dear old John Taylor, the double martyr, who said he would go to his grave before he did compromise, although he compromised a number of times before his grave about polygamy? But that image, where do you find your feelings of nostalgia? And in many ways, I think this issue of the abandonment of polygamy is like the lost cause of the Confederacy. Are you nostalgic for what was lost after 1865, including slavery? Or do you see the rise of the New South as a difficult but laudable, spiritually improved version of what it means to be a human, what it means to be an American? And believe me, that still is very much a part of the South. I lived in New Orleans for 3 years, which most Southerners said this isn't the South. But nonetheless, I would go to see some of these monuments. And one of them, I remember, they're not even monuments. They're just inscriptions on the light poles on Canal Street in the financial district of New Orleans. And they give certain dates of date periods of New Orleans history. and the Confederacy is one, and the period of foreign occupation is another, after the Confederacy. So there is a nostalgia that operates in the South that is very real for the antebellum period. And if you were to talk to a number of white Southerners, slavery is part of that. It's too bad we had to give that up. So, and there are other white Southerners today who are just appalled, who have publicly apologized for the fact that their ancestors maintained slavery. They're humiliated by that background. So I think that's another part of, you know, and it's a very personal issue. But I think it's one that is, it defines Mormon culture and the divisions in Mormon culture, just as the nostalgia for the lost cause or the nostalgia for wasn't it great that things had to change even though it was difficult. That's a dividing point in Southern society even now.
I think that's a very rich historical analogy, and you could take it in a number of directions. If there are any graduate students here, that would be a good way to explore the issue. And I think also in terms of shame. Shame. I think that the extent to which shame fuels Southern... I live in the South now, in Nashville, and the extent to which the lady doth protest too much with the rebel flags and all that means. But yes, I think that I've often wondered about the issue of shame in Mormonism and how we define plural marriage. It's almost a litmus test how we see marriage, either as a sexual practice, an economic practice, or a theological priestly practice. And increasingly, it seems to me, and this is, I'll venture an observation, though not an answer to the question. I don't know that there's an answer to the question that's posed here. An observation about the matter is because we do not have an explanation that has integrated this change into our theology, we are more vulnerable to sexualizing this practice and to feeling the sense of shame. And this will show my bias towards and being co-opted by the cultural definitions of that practice.
Did you say sexualizing or essentializing?
Sexualizing.
Sexualizing. Okay.
Eroticizing.
Eroticizing it, yeah.
Well, that's another issue of how we remember the abandonment of polygamy also, and it goes to the heart of this nostalgia. I think the answer to what do we feel nostalgia for is the question of do we think of polygamy as eroticized or not? And if we think of polygamy as eroticized as Mormons, we probably have nostalgia for Wilford Woodruff and what a brave and insightful and inspired man he was to issue the manifesto. If we perceive polygamy as not essentially eroticized, but if we see it as primarily a religious practice, then we're very likely to feel nostalgia for the pre-manifesto time period. And it's kind of like, oh, the slaves were happy in the big house.
Weren't they?
We don't worry about the ones that ended up being beaten nearly to death or to death out in the fields.
Did you want to...
A friend of mine once observed that if Mormons were the Catholic Church, then Arizona would be Spain. And for those of you who don't know, Spain gave the Catholics the Inquisition. They took their religion very seriously in Spain. And I'm from an Arizona Mormon family. And it occurred to me in the course of writing this book that I was trying to answer my grandfather's question, which was... And he never said it to me, but it's just what you intuit in families. You all have questions you inherited. Was what happened? Now, he wasn't polygamist, but he was the son of a polygamist. And I don't know that it was the end of polygamy so much as it was, for lack of a better word, the modernization of the church during the Progressive Era. What happened? the church he grew up in was gone. I even heard my father talk about that. The church he grew up in was gone. And so some of the nostalgia you talk about drifts towards polygamy as the marker, and I would suggest as sacrifice. Polygamy, for those who do not eroticize polygamy in their understanding of the practice, polygamy can also stand for the measure of sacrifice in the church. In the good old days when you didn't just have to walk a block to go to church, you know, and people really meant it and they worked hard for it and lived it. And that kind of nostalgia becomes part of polygamy too.
Well, with all due regards to Kathleen and Mike, the first book I read on this time period was Tom Alexander's volume on this time period in what would have been the sesquicentennial history series. The thing I got out of that book was what an turbulent, mixed up time. Not only were we changing polygamy, but we were changing a score of other practices. The auxiliaries were all in flux. The priesthood quorums were being reorganized. Doctrines were being jettisoned and added and rewritten and de-emphasized and other ones emphasized. And as a historian, trying to read all these documents with all these different things and so many different people, even in the quorums, saying different things and pushing different things, how in the hell do you make sense of all of this and try to come up with an overarching arc, you know, story arc or something, and that makes sense to someone reading a book which should put all the pieces together? What kind of task is that, and how confident are you sure that you've got it right?
There's an Irish phrase I love that things can be somewhat of a mulligan stew. And I like that because the idea of a stew is something you cannot see through. It's not like a broth. It's dark. It's thick. And it is, I think, an apt description of this time period in that it's not easy to perceive what's happening. And you can identify somebody, for example, like a Charles W. Penrose, a polygamist who becomes anti-polygamist, and you can identify him and say, all right, on this issue, I understand his point of view, and why his point of view is as it was. But then you get to an issue like his reading and his take on the King Follett discourse and the theology of the King Follett discourse, and your neat little descriptions of where he fits on some kind of theological or political spectrum of worldview don't hold up on this other area of change and reassessment that's going on during the same period. And it is very much of a mulligan stew. The easy definitions don't apply to anybody. And it's easy to say, all right, Francis M. Lyman was this. And you look at him with reference to plural marriage, and it can be very consistent. Until you find out that, lo and behold, Francis M. Lyman performed a legal polygamous marriage in the Salt Lake Temple. A stake president had a first wife who died. He had a second wife who was alive, married before the manifesto. He wanted to marry another wife. He asked Francis Lyman if this was okay. Francis Lyman said, oh yes, and I'll be glad to perform the ceremony. And so here you have a man who's perceived as this consistent opponent of post-manifesto polygamy, who is perfectly willing to perform what is a de facto new plural marriage and to perform it in the Salt Lake Temple as a public record ordinance, while this is obviously a new plural marriage, but it's legal because the first wife is no longer alive. And then you begin to realize that your readings of this complex time period and the roles people played in it are are going to be subject to a lot of, well, there was this exception. Well, there was that exception. And it is not easily defined. And you have, as Albert pointed out, so many areas of transition that Tom Alexander's book does a wonderful job in analyzing. Really the labels don't apply, the liberal, the conservative, the reactionary, the progressive, because if you look at an individual and look at all the areas of transition that were going on, you'll find that individual on multiple sides of these areas of transition that don't fit a consistent pattern that would fit with your definition of what you think of that person being in his consistent view of things, if you look at him with reference to only one of those issues. And this issue with Francis M. Lyman, I would never have expected that. I was stunned when I discovered this. And yet, Francis M. Lyman never apologized for that. His answer was, when he was criticized for it, it was a legal ceremony. It was a legal marriage. And I performed a legal marriage under the laws of Utah. End of story. And he wasn't concerned with the fact that it was a de facto polygamous relationship because a pre-existing marriage was in effect, and it did continue, and so that the man had a de facto plural wife who was now his legal wife. And he had a pre-existing marriage that continued sexually.
I was trying to find a place in a book where I disagreed with Mike on the second manifesto and your interpretation of the role of the witnesses that Joseph F. Smith used, but the point is people can look at the same data and disagree, and I'm not sure there's any way to say whether Mike was right or I was right, because all you can do is to say this is how I look at the data. I respond to Mike's analysis and say this is why I think otherwise, though I think the end result was we agreed in that Joseph F. didn't mean the second manifesto, but I don't know. Just, you'll see that in the book. You'll see Albert's question illustrated in the book, making sense out of the elements of the past that come down to us is we are self-conscious about it now. We make sense out of our present sense. And someone's going to come along in 20 years or 50 years and make another kind of sense out of the same material. Ultimately, history seeks to illuminate the present. It says as much about us as it does about them. And I think historians have to know that. And so when Albert asks the question, how do you make sense, you do it humbly, because your words taste much sweeter if you do. Because you'll have to eat some of them. And that's not... My disagreement with Mike, it was not of that kind at all. It really was looking at the same facts and saying, looking at motives. And you never know about motives unless they leave a journal that says, and for those of you going to come along 20 years later, this is what I meant when I did, and don't misunderstand me. And I don't think any of you are leaving journals like that. So historians are always trying to understand. I think the other thing that the reader needs to be aware of to find history useful is that all history is written in response to a question. The author has a question. And the question provides both a frame and a boundary. So the author will signal, I'm not going to look at X and I'm not going to look at Y. I think Mike's point about the millennial expectation shifting, I think that's right on, but I didn't look at that in my book because my questions arose from a different set of concerns. I was trying to illuminate something else. And how do you know you're right? To some extent, it has to do with the quality of your research. And you can never really... In history, you have to arbitrarily stop because one thing always leads to another. What I try to do in my book, and it's both the boon and the curse of electronic means of keeping research notes is in the different libraries I'd go to and all the documents, I would translate them into digital text, and then all these separate sets of correspondence, I merge them into one document chronologically. So I knew what Francis Lyman was saying, to the extent that we had the information, what he was saying to Joseph F. Smith, and what Smoot was saying to Badger, his secretary. And often these events, you would kind of, there were moments when I'd just strike it rich, and they were all talking about the same thing. And they were either saying the same thing or different things, or they were talking about each other, not knowing that somebody else was. And so I had these 5 years of correspondence among members of the quorum, and then press comments to the press and telegrams and journals and newspaper accounts both locally and in Washington that would begin to give more than a would show, if you will, a three-dimensional picture of the action during the period. And so that's how I tried to shore up my interpretation. My book is largely an interpretive exercise as history. You could read Tom Alexander and you could read Mike and all the data, and I try very carefully to give them credit for the data I analyze, but my book is more overtly an analysis of the heroic research they did into the period. And I try to fill in the motivations among the human actors in this to make meaning out of this event of the abandonment of polygamy. Because it never really made sense to me that they finally said, okay, you're bigger than we are, we quit. Because clearly they didn't quit.
Well, speaking of motivations, one of the things that troubled me was Joseph F. Smith under testimony at the Senate hearings, lying for the Lord. You know, we read those and they say, Brother Smith, is that all? Yes. Well, aren't you president of some corporations? Well, maybe no, I can't think of any more. Well, and they'd list five. Well, you and I, Idaho, or what, all these things. And they'd say, oh, yeah, I am president of those. And they'd say, are those all President Smith? And he'd say, yes, that's all. And then they'd list another five. Oh, come to mention that I am president of those. And it went on like that, pages and pages and pages of him being such a reluctant testimony and not willing to give an inch. And it seems to me almost lying. But neither Kathleen or Mike are comfortable with the phrase lying for the Lord. And so that's the most sensational part of those hearings, I think. There's plenty of sensation in those hearings. But that's one of the most famous ones. Do you want to comment on the project of lying for the Lord? Because it really disillusioned me for one point in my life.
The reason I don't like the idea of lying for the Lord as describing that is that the Mormon Commonwealth up into 1890 perceived itself as a theocracy. And one of the changes that actually we all are writing about, Tom Alexander and both of us, is this abandonment of theocracy and the theocratic worldview. And what does that mean in terms of our religion? What does that mean in terms of our sense of being Americans? Well, the Mormons had a very clear perception prior to 1890 of what it meant to be in a theocratic commonwealth and to also be patriotic Americans. No other American shared that confidence or point of view, but Mormons in Utah did. And within that theocratic framework were a set of ethics that I call theocratic ethics. And the idea essentially is what Joseph Smith expressed in the letter that was written in 1842 and by various circumstantial evidences. It was a part of a letter of proposal that he was writing to an intended plural wife. It's published in the history of the church as an essay on happiness, which is ironic in a variety at several levels. But part of that is whatever God commands is right. That pushes Mormonism beyond Plato's ethics, beyond Plato's Republic, beyond Christian ethics as defined at that time. The idea that human values, including words that are value-laden, utterly value-laden, like lying, don't apply. And so that's why I'm uncomfortable with the use of the word lying to the Lord, or lying for the Lord, rather, to describe the testimony before the Congress, before the Senate. Statements were made which were contrary to the fact, but those men who were making them had been, including Joseph F. Smith as president, had been members of a theocratic council, which was called the Kingdom of God, which was nicknamed the Council of 50, in which they took oaths that the kingdom was paramount. And even though the Council of 50 itself didn't meet after October 1884, these men were not unforgetful or unmindful, nor were they forgetful about those oaths that they had taken. So that's why I don't like the concept of lying for the Lord. However, if we were going to look at the church today is not a theocracy. Its leaders do not perceive themselves as governing a theocracy. They do not have a theocratic worldview. They have adopted in large measure the conservative values of middle America. Therefore, when leaders today say things that they know are contrary to the fact, then they are doing so to protect the church, its image, themselves, perhaps. And then in that context, I think lying for the Lord is an appropriate description, because they're not operating out of a theocracy or a theocratic worldview. This transition period is the transition between the theocracy and the church as a civilly protected institution within a civil republic. And that is certainly the position that the leaders of the church see now. The kingdom of God is a phrase that doesn't have the same meaning to them as the kingdom of God did to Joseph F. Smith and others who testified before Congress under oath and said things that were contrary to the fact and knew that they were doing so.
Mike's answer is a lot more philosophical than mine. Mine comes from the more pragmatic analysis of the law and how it works, particularly in trials. I didn't believe that Joseph F. Smith did lie. That what problems I have with the phrase "lying for the Lord" are largely that it now obscures as much as it illuminates to use that phrase. People tend to use it as an accusation rather as a way to understand a particular dynamic, the one that Mike has described here. How I treat it in the book is, and Albert uses an example, it's a marvelous record. When Joseph F. Smith sits down, they ask him, you know, what's your name? Kind of name, rank, and serial number. What's your name? Where do you live? How long have you lived there? Like they do for all witnesses. And what's your title? And he says, President of the Church. And he says, do you have any other titles? This is the attorney for the people who are protesting Smoot's seating. He says, no. Now, if I were Joseph F.'s lawyer at that point, I'd say, don't start now. They know. They know. They know that you are called a prophet, seer, and a revelator. And sure enough, the next question is, are you not called a prophet, seer, and revelator? And he says, some people say so. And he's tough. He is very tough. I mean, you read this hearing, and I just think you'll walk away respecting him. But he sits there for 4.5 days and is pistol whipped. That's not easy, to be cross-examined, not only by counsel, but by the lawyers who are sitting on that panel, who are senators, and who freely intervene and question him. And he holds his own, which astounded the nation, because they're reading the transcript throughout. So on the one hand, I see him as what you've heard this phrase, a hostile witness. And a hostile witness is asked and answered, right? What do you have the time? Yes. That's not lying. He does that all the time. The other thing he does that I think is so disconcerting to a lot of people is, and I was turning to the book to get an example of the phrases he uses. He's very careful in his language. And he will say, the church never authorized. No polygamous marriage was performed after 1890 with the knowledge and permission of the church. It's always the church, the church, the church. And of course, this, he's making a distinction between the church as an institution and its leadership.
So the council in the first presidency may have authorized it, but not the church.
That's right. Now, you hear this all the time. You've done it too, right? This is, so does he mean to mislead? You betcha. Does, you know, is he fencing with them? There's a marvelous exchange where they're trying to get around these language problems. You see this with lawyers all the time. And so rather than ask Smith if he performed a plural marriage, Senator Burroughs, I think it is, will say, it was Julius Caesar Burroughs. You know, we just don't give people names like they deserve anymore. Julius Caesar Burroughs says to Joseph F. Smith, did you perform a ceremony of any kind on Catalina Island? And he says, no. Was he lying? No, because he'd done it in the Salt Lake Temple. Did he lie? No. Did he mislead? You betcha. But that's the way the game is played. The job of the lawyer is to ask you the kind of question that you cannot answer that way. You know, I've said this before. A good lawyer is trained not to ask any question that she doesn't already know the answer to. And when you ask your question, you give the witness two choices. You can either make an admission against your interest, or you can perjure yourself. That's the only choice a good lawyer will give you on the witness stand. Unless you're a very smart witness and you'll split the difference. And you see Joseph F. Smith doing this for 4.5 days. It's incredible to read. And he's obfuscating. He's misleading. He's, you know, every possible way to get around that. And he does it. Now, let's go to the other question about lying. I'm also troubled this lying for the Lord, as if there is a simple way of saying something is and is not a lie, or it's always wrong to lie. You all know that if you lived in Germany in 1939 and somebody knocked on your door and said, are there any Jews here? What would you say? I cannot tell a lie. Yes, go to my basement. No, you're not going to do that. And so there are books written. This is where I would go more towards the area of philosophy with Michael. There are books written about the ethics of lying. Now, that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but the ethics of lying. And it is absolutely predictable that when they talk about lying, they'll say that when people are in a state of war, it is understood that they will lie. It's just a given. And you read the language on both sides of this hearing, and these people felt they were in the state of war. Anton H. Lund will record in his journal, so-and-so went back to the seat of war today. And he's talking about Washington, D.C. Not everybody was as successful as Joseph F. Smith. My favorite was Mariner W. Merrill's son, Charles, who was married by his father to a plural wife. And since they can't get the father, they've got the sons back there. The father's ill. And he has to try to testify that his father didn't know that when he was marrying him to a second wife. And so the questions go, well, where do you live? Well, across the street from my parents. Well, you know, don't you think he knew? Well, you know, my mother knew, but I'm not sure my father knew. I'm not sure she ever told him. And it goes on and on like this. But it's, remember, this is not a fact-finding trial. This is a political trial. The idea is to negotiate change in a very public forum. And so the ultimate question that they ask Charles is, which do you believe in obeying, the law of the land or the law of the Lord? Now, how would you answer that question? And they all have to answer that question. And they do the best they can. And old Charles says, finally, he's exhausted, obviously. He says, I don't think I can answer that question. And, you know, Reed Smoot says he would move. He says, if you put me in that position, I'd move. Well, let's say you couldn't move. I mean, they're just merciless. So remember, when you talk about lying for the Lord, you, and I don't mean this in any kind of relative moral, you know, kind of moral relativity of postmodernism. You really do have to look at the context of this trial. And so, yes, I do get impatient with people who think of lying for the Lord. Having said that, I'm with Michael on this, in the world that these people lived in, I'm not sure I wouldn't be right there with them, you know, asked and answered, you know, do you have the time? Yes. You know, talking about the giving the church a corporate identity and existence. Into, I mean, these are the way people talk politically, and that's what the church did. And they did it for years.
Well, it makes the answer to the question that Bill Clinton gave, you know, simple. You know, it all depends on what you mean by is.
And that, may I say, as a Democrat, that was war as well.
Okay, so that's what will probably be our last question is, talk about how people now, or in time removed from that experience, look at it and reinterpret it through nostalgia or whatever. I want to get back to how the people who had to live through it, and the common saints and local church leaders and other church leaders, and even the hierarchy, tried to make sense of what was happening to them at that time. And as part of that, you know, there's that quote that, you know, when you're up to your waist in alligators, you forget that the original intention was to drain the swamp. You know, when they're in the middle of that whole mess, were they just so caught up fighting all those little brush fires and trying to just get through for another day or another week or another year? Or do you think they had any sense that this really was the great accommodation and that they were putting the church on the fast track to the American mainstream? Or did that just never enter their mind? And looking back, we can see this is where we turned the corner and entered the freeway. So how do they make sense of that at the time? Because they still wanted to be believing Mormons, yet everything was changing. Who wants to go first?
There's a couple of questions in that.
Yeah, it's called cheating.
Yeah, I said earlier, I don't think that historical actors know the consequences of their actions entirely. They have their intentions, and I think it's only fair to judge their success in light of what they were able to perceive. I don't know that they understood what the church would become downstream from this damming up and, you know, rearranging the flow of certain things. As for how they experienced it, I argue in this book that I believe they knew they were at risk of schism over the hearings. In 1905, Frank J. Cannon, who was a writer for the Tribune that year, began publishing the testimony of Joseph F. Smith at the trial during the time of General Conference, with headlines like God's Appointed Liar. Very subtle in those days, very subtle. And Joseph F., of course, they had grown up together. Joseph F. used to refer to him as Furious Judas Cannon, because he was Frank J., right? Those were his initials, of Furious Judas Cannon. So they knew, and the boat was really rocking and reeling out there in Salt Lake in 1905. And people were reading the testimony. One of the more poignant things I found in the church archives was a notebook called, and on the title was written, A Woman of Mormondom. And Sarah Pearson had written her response to the Smoot hearings. And she was so angry at James Talmage for his, what she thought was the abandonment of the women who had sacrificed so much and lived the principle, when he called them not real wives, essentially his testimony. And she was just outraged by this and said it was so wrong of him to speak so disrespectfully. And of course, James Talmage was on the witness stand with all that I said a few minutes ago. But nonetheless, again, I'll refer to a friend of mine who tells of his grandmother who brought them in as grandchildren and said, "I don't understand polygamy. You may never understand it either, but you are not to speak ill of it because none of you would be here without it." And that sense, I think there was a period of betrayal. And again, it was hard for me to try to imagine the audience that Joseph F. Smith was speaking to when he demanded that they not only abandon polygamy, but they forgive the world. And these people would actually lived through that moment, were then asked to forgive. I don't think we can understand how confusing and destabilizing that was for them. But we can see it best in the quorum and the records they left. I don't know about the records for the others. And they were reeling, really. My assessment was that they were on the edge of schism.
The reactions were probably as complex as you could imagine. And the ones that I read first were ones like Sarah Pearson's. Carl Badger's is another direction. Carl Badger, like J. Reuben Clark, were among those who defined themselves as modern Mormons, who were proud of the... They didn't look with no nostalgia at polygamy, even though it was a source of their births in many cases. And they instead welcomed the manifesto and thought that the manifesto itself was this 180-degree turn, and that everything was moving the church into assimilation with America. And then the Smoot hearings blew that apart for them, and they felt absolutely betrayed. And it's very clear in Badger's diaries and letters that feeling of absolute betrayal, that the church had deceived him and deceived the world, and he was outraged. And J. Reuben Clark felt the same. And yet both of them had relatives who were involved in post-manifesto polygamy. And J. Reuben Clark's bishop in Grantsville had married plural wives after the manifesto. And his cousins had been wives and husbands. So it was a very deeply disturbing experience for people who lived in the Mormon culture region. For Mormons in Georgia, I doubt it had much meaning, except that they saw it in these war terms. The church is being attacked. They didn't see it in the complexities that people who were basically torn by conflicting loyalties in Mormon culture region did see it.
Kathleen, did you talk about this in your first one? Maybe you can close with these little comments, because there was the ray of hope. In giving up Joseph's last revelation, they turned to his first.
Yes, I talked about that.
Okay, then we don't need to do that again. But this was also the time when the first vision came to preeminence in Mormon history as a way of affirming our allegiance to the founding prophet. Well, time's up. This has been fun. Corner them in the hallways. Thanks.
I don't think it was primarily a display of status. In fact, I think economically it could destabilize their status. I think to the extent that polygamy was related to priesthood office. See, I can't go with that. I think that what you see is polygamy related to priesthood office. And so once polygamy was dropped, you still have the priesthood office as the status. So I think I don't know that I can buy the assumption, so I can't give the answer. It was an element of it possibly, but you know.